We went to the washroom. I was told that I needed to strip down, take off all my clothes, and drop them on the floor, and somebody would pick them up. And I was thinking, these are my brand new clothes, my brand new moccasins, you know, that I was so proud of.
If you listened to my last episode, you know I took a journey to my great-grandparents' homestead in Arizona, and the house was no longer there. What was left of their life was gone, replaced only by rocky desert soil and large cactus. I sat in my camp chair, seeing nothing and everything all at once. And I wondered about the lives we lead because of the stories we're told, and how those stories differ from the promises that are made. My great-grandparents moved west following the American dream. They just lived through the Great Depression. They were following Manifest Destiny, which inspired thousands of white settlers to become pioneers. Most were hard on their luck without prospects. They were promised empty land, just waiting for good, hardworking Americans to make the desert flourish. They were promised a better life. My great-grandma and grandpa endured harsh conditions. They continually struggled for water and electricity. They shot deer for dinner and built a house by hand out of rocks. Life was not easy. They suffered the loss of a child. They struggled to make ends meet. And they built community, held school and church in their living room, and left a legacy of love and compassion that I still feel today. It was all of the above. It was complicated. As I sat there, I wondered about the lives lived on that same land before my great-grandparents had forged a home in the middle of the cacti and coyotes. I wondered about the indigenous people who'd lived there before my family arrived. I'd wondered about the stories they were told and the promises they were made. Only 100 miles, an hour and a half from where I sat, is a Navajo reservation. I'd grown up perhaps knowing a little bit more than most people do about the conflicting stories of the settlers and the Native people. My great uncle, Jerry Jacka, spent his 50-year career taking haunting, beautiful photos of the Hopi people, who allowed him into their homes and their community. But now, as I spend months chronicling what the American dream means, depending upon who you are, I wanted to know more. My curiosity led me to Bessie Smith, who started her life on that Navajo reservation just a distance down the Arizona highway from where I sat. She would tell me a very different story about promises made and promises twisted. For over 100 years, Indigenous parents were forced to send their children to boarding schools in Canada and the United States. At least 150,000 children were taken. Bessie Smith was one of them. This is Complexified, where religion and politics collide with real life. I'm your host, Amanda Henderson. Welcome to Season 4, Dreaming America. On a hot August afternoon back in Denver, I walk up the sidewalk to her little house. The door has pots of bright flowers on each side, and Bessie welcomes me in. She's fighting the 90-degree heat with multiple fans and has set out a pitcher of water and two glasses in the middle of the kitchen table. Stacks of turquoise beads and thread and jewelry-making tools are pushed to the corner of the table. On the wall is one of those Olin Mills pictures from the 80s with a younger Bessie and her husband and kids, and a photo of her grandkids is nearby. After we settle in, I ask her to tell me about the day her parents told her she'd be leaving them to go to a boarding school. She was 12.
I lived the Navajo way of life traditionally, as well as my parents instilling in me all the values and all the know-hows that I was going to learn and possess to be a good mother, to be a good wife, and to be a good provider as I moved into my adulthood. But things was going to change. My dad told me that the government is expecting us parents to allow our children to go to a boarding school, whether it's a church, religious boarding school, or a government boarding school. It's been a law that was put out there, that's what he said, that if we didn't, as adults, did not allow children to go to school and freely let them go, that the parents would may go to jail. Because an example, which was where we were told that our neighboring tribe, the Hopi tribe, there were about 20 parents, I believe it was told, who refused to allow their children to go to a government boarding school, and they were imprisoned in Alcatraz. It's the severest, and the severest being that Alcatraz was a federal prison.
It's impossible to imagine having the government come to my door and force me to hand over my children or go to jail. But this is what happened to thousands of Indian parents. I'd never heard this story of the Hopi parents sent to Alcatraz. In that impossible situation, Bessie's parents made the difficult choice to take her to the boarding school. I wonder what that felt like for them. I asked Bessie what that felt like for her.
Having learned to be who I was at the time, I felt like, well, I guess I can do it. So right after my ceremony meaning that when a girl reaches puberty, that's a very serious ceremony at that point, because the girl or the woman has now become a woman, and but their body have been blessed with ability to have children and therefore eligible to be married. My mother was given away in marriage to my dad when she was only a little over 12. And that was the practice at the time. So I had my two ceremony. One, the first time I got my period, and then the second time. And then by that time, it was time that the new sessions were starting. So my dad said, we're going to take you there, and they're going to take care of you. Don't worry. So my mother made me some nice traditional-looking dress, my moccasins, my jewelry. I was so proud of my hair. My hair was down to below the waistline. And we all spoke Navajo. I knew no English. And traditional food and my belief system was healing ceremonies, healing way of living belief. And our creator was our creator. The day came, we left in the wagon. It was about 45 miles away, south of where we was born. I was born way out there on the reservation where there was no hospital. The trip was memorable to me because I was enjoying the travel with my parents, and I enjoyed the ride there. And so I was excited, actually very excited, and I knew nothing. I knew very little about what was going to come. So as we got to the boarding school, which is called Tulani Lake Boarding School, it was about noon because the smell of food. A lot of children were in line to get their food, and the boys were lined up on one side, the girls were lined up on the other side, and everybody looked the same. Haircut the same. The look. The boys. But their behavior was kind of weird because they were all laughing at me because I had my traditional clothes on. I was so proud of myself as I approached the building. And I thought, well, I have never been around that many people at one time. So I thought, well, I'll just go join them. Well, I couldn't not join them because it was time for me to be taken to the washroom because a new student coming into the Mensa for children who are already there was kind of risky because their explanation was that living on a reservation, you probably have lice, you probably have bugs in your hair, and you're not clean. So to get orientation, there was an interpreter, a man, and a woman. We went to the washroom, and at that point, I was told that I needed to strip down, take off all my clothes, and drop them on the floor, and somebody would pick them up. And I was thinking, these are my brand new clothes, my brand new moccasins, my brand new clothes, you know, that I was so proud of, and what are they going to do with it? And I immediately wanted to start crying, but I thought, I have to remember that I'm a woman now. I'm not a child because I have my ceremony. And there's a man sitting over in the corner. He was playing with some scissors. He was going to go cut my hair. I found that out later. So I got in the shower. The lady, she told me, she says, when's the last time that you wash your hair? And I said, yesterday. It's almost like you don't wash your clothes or you're just dirty. That's the impression I was getting. But little did I know that there was more to it than just taking your clothes off and washing and preparing me to lose my hair, because our hair is really considered to be sacred. I just had my ceremony and my hair was blessed. My hair was my crown. That's where my energy, and when I pray, that's where I put the corn pollen and do my prayers. So sure enough, I come out of the shower. They wrapped me in a towel, sat down on a chair, and my hair was cut. Just straight right below my ear. The whole thing just fell to the floor.
Do you remember that feeling?
It was just such a, it's almost like an invasion of your being. Mm. It was like, and then next was, I was given some clothing that was supposed to be modern clothes or modern to that day. It looked like, looking back, it looked like Irene. What is her, that Beverly Hillbillies?
Oh, yeah.
Granny. I got granny clothes. And that was so foreign to me. So at the orientation into the bathroom, they kept calling me a name, and I didn't know that was my name, Bessie. And then finally the interpreter said, Elonlige. I said, Zapahinishye. That means, my name is Zapaha, and that Zapaha is my name. And then she goes, they've been calling you Bessie, and the reason is Bessie is your name, not Zapaha. And you don't use that name anymore because that's Navajo. Mm. So Zapaha got my name, Bessie. And immediately I forgot what the word was.
Imagine for a minute, you're 12 years old. Strangers have told you to strip naked. Your clothes have been taken, your hair cut. Your hair, that you experience as sacred, falling to the floor. And you're told you have a new name, a name in a language you don't even understand. You are all alone.
So at that moment, is when I asked for my parents. Mm-hmm. And the lady who was the interpreter, she said, oh, they left. I said, what do you mean they left? In Navajo, this is all Navajo. And they said, well, they took your clothes and you're under our care now. And they have gone. I said, are they going to come back? No, you're going to school. You're going to teach English. By the way, starting today, you have to speak English only. You cannot speak Navajo language anymore. You have to put aside all your Navajo ways aside. So that started escalating to invade my mind and my feelings and my way that I knew was going to be rocky road for me.
Yeah. In that moment, you had your hair taken.
My language.
And your language.
My being, because I stood bare, naked in front of all these people. And clothing. My clothes were gone. My shoes were gone. They're not shoes, they're moccasins. And I never even got a chance to ask my mom, how do I run in the morning? Because that was my life. I would get up, take my corn pollen, and I would go as far as I could. And then I would take the pollen and you just put it on your, kind of like making a cross. And say your prayer, turn around and run back, because running is taking in the positive energy, the pure energy that's out there, and it cleanses your lungs and everything. And I couldn't do that anymore. And they said, well, we do go for a walk, you know, like, and that wasn't something that I wanted. This is all in Navajo, so this is not like running track or anything. So there in one day, my belief system was stopped. It was my belief, you know, it's just like, and I lost my parents. My parents not coming back. And the institution became my parents. And that's probably the most painful moment in my life that I carry with me.
What kind of trauma is experienced when everything you are, everything you have is taken from you? It's easy to think of the tragedies of our past in this country as in the past. But when I think about the ways that the lives of my grandparents, my great-grandparents, continue to shape my life, I realize that 100 years isn't that long. And all of these stories and experiences are still very much with us today. I ask Bessie about the experiences she had in the boarding school that continue to shape her.
So from there, I cried a lot. I started school when I was 12, and my belief system, everything that I valued, were set.
Yeah,
by that age, you're matured at that point.
Formed, yeah, in many ways.
And so to go through that loss really becomes more horribly impact to lose it. From there, I decided I'm going to go forward. I'm going to learn English. And there was one teacher, her name was Myrtle Thompson. She was from Missouri. She knew I was running behind on grade-wise. I was should have been in the third or fourth grade. And she taught me English. I wasn't allowed to go into her house or anything. So after dinner, I would sit outside her window. And she taught me everything that was in the kitchen. I learned it, but I didn't know what they were, you know. Mm-hmm. But as time went on, it all made sense. Another knock on the head was that we were advised that on Sunday we would all congregate in the dining room after breakfast, and that we're going to have a program. And then non-Native people came. It was, I guess, that they were the missionaries from Flagstaff, Arizona. The first group that came had a Navajo man who was an interpreter. There were songs that we were told that we had to learn. And and they sang, and we tried to sing, but we couldn't. So after that, I met the man, interpreted, pointed me out to come with him. So as we went into the next room, he says, "Have you been saved?" I didn't know what that meant. "Have you been saved?" In Navajo, it's stunning, stunning Zaya. That's it. That means, no, I don't know what that means. He said, "Well, your family used medicine men to heal you." I said, "Oh, yeah." I got so excited. You know, I said, "Oh, yeah, twice, two or three times." And I had my puberty ceremony and all that. And then he goes, "I just want you to know you're going to hell."
Not far from that boarding school, missionaries would visit my great-grandparents' little Baptist church, the one that started in their living room. They would share stories celebrating the Indians they had saved and the children they were caring for. Converting Native people to Christianity was seen as the key to civilizing Indigenous people. At my great-grandparents' church, this was spoken of as helping and charitable, and part of their destiny as Christians. Religious institutions ran more than half of early Indian boarding schools. Even after protests against religious oversight of federal boarding schools in the 1930s and then again in the 1970s, missionaries continued to be invited to live and work in the schools. They managed programs and held church services, and they physically punished the children. They pressured the children to convert. They told them things like, "I just want you to know you're going to hell."
And so that was really my first introduction to Christianity, mm-hmm. or what's supposed to be Christianity. So I worried about that. At night, I thought about it, like, pretty soon somebody's going to come for me and I'm going to go to hell. Like, and I asked him, "Where's hell?" He said, "I can't tell you because you'll earn it by, if you don't get saved," because he didn't explain what being saved meant. And so I just thought, "What do I have to do to get saved?" And he said, "Well, just you have to go to church every Sunday." I said, "Where's the church?" And many years passed, felt like many years. Probably the following year, I found out that I had earned enough credits and that I learned enough English to be transported to Fort Wingate, New Mexico. That is way further away than where I've ever been. Fort Wingate was an introduction to being with people from different tribes. They were all Native, but many of them were from local pueblos. They were like Acoma, Laguna. Many of them were from Albuquerque. So there were maybe at least 10 different tribes, people who went there. That was a kind of a weird encounter. Mm-hmm. So I became so aware of the difference in myself when I entered public school in Winslow, Arizona. I had earned enough grade to be a junior in high school. I didn't know. I didn't know I was that good. Here I started at late age, and yeah. I'm like ready to graduate from somewhere. So I became more aware that I was in class with white people, other Native people, Black people, Hispanic or Latinos. And it was just mystifying to me. The Native people seemed to like speak their language once in a while, and I could listen to it. And we were so forbidden to speak our language, we didn't dare speak it. How I got to Winslow was to be transferred to a government border town dormitory. And there was, what, like six different border towns where they were going to build these dormitories for Native kids so they can integrate with the public school kids. But we didn't have any warning of how to behave. We didn't expect that they were, we were going to be encountering a lot of racism, discrimination, that we were different. And it was pretty scary the first time that I left the dorm and we all marched to the high school. That's so obvious, you know, and I heard people yelling, "Oh, look at those Indians marching to the school. They should go home to the reservation." And we heard that over and over with the group that I was walking to school with. And it really bothered me because I felt, but I didn't have anybody that I could talk to. About that time, I began to experience a self-hate desire to be somebody else. I felt like who I am is not what other people want. I mean, this is so, I'm expressing it because that's my interpretation of the way I was feeling. You know, my, nobody told me. And I decided that I would be different. I'm going to try not to be Indian. I'm going to try to be different and not be brown skin. Lose my high cheekbone. Lose my accent. Because I was just starting to speak fluently in English, so. But we got punished for speaking Navajo most of the time, so that was a way to try to stay away from getting punished, so you just don't speak your language. And that was happening at the dormitory during my junior and senior year.
Sometimes people who have been hurt or abused or discriminated against take on these messages they've been told and start to believe them. This can be very confusing and so difficult to overcome. I've seen how difficult this is to overcome in my own family, and I wondered if this is what Bessie experienced. Bessie shared that after boarding school and the difficult experiences of high school, she went with a friend to Fort Lewis College. Somehow, she continued to find her way, find her voice, and build resilience. At Fort Lewis, she met her husband, and they would move to Denver. She shared that we would need an entire book to talk about all of the different obstacles she experienced through those years. Sitting at that kitchen table, I wondered how, at 83 years old, Bessie reflects back on her experience of this idea of the American dream. I wonder how she holds the tension of her pain, the pain of her people, and also finds joy.
My dream has been to survive. My dream has been to someday heal my pain and be happy for the rest of my life in a, within my family. In way back, many years ago, in the late 1800s, my people were forced to leave our land and walk to Fort Sumner, New Mexico, so that we can be shipped to Oklahoma and that my people will live in Oklahoma among other Indian people there. We are Navajo. The pain of being resentful that other people's dream have come true. They took our land. They took our minerals, our wealth of the earth. Evidently was not meant for us. We have other wealth that we can acquire, our family wealth that we can have survived, and we're still here.
Can you tell a story of your own experience of finding healing?
I worked for University of Colorado Health Science Center for many years. I negotiated a way that I could leave and still get my retirement. There was a little devil in me that was just wouldn't go away. Everything I did, it either made me feel insecure. It felt like I can't do it. Or somebody else is doing it. Or blaming others and not quite feeling serene. Not quite feeling satisfied that when I leave this earth, that I'm going to be 100% happy that I have existed and have made some kind of difference. In order to make a difference in any way, I realized I had to heal myself. And I thought about the things I had lost in my life. I thought about our traditional way of life. I spoke with my mother that I was going to attempt to have a business of doing jewelry, and they're going to be different. I'm going to incorporate other elements of the earth into this making jewelry, and they're going to have names, and I'm going to name my business Zapaha. Zapaha is my name. With stones that were sacred in our healing ceremony, I would use it to heal myself and then put it away in a jewelry and pass it on to somebody else in good way. So to this day, we have been able to incorporate things like juniper berries, which a lot of people look at as purification element, the smudging, the ghost beads, turquoise, stones of various type that come from the earth, that they were put there by our creator, and learn from it that people look to stones of crystal as a healing stone, and we respect that. And so when I do jewelry, that's what we do. We're able to create fetishes because they all have significance to our culture, and that I am proud that I can be. I have allowed myself to take that journey to create beauty in wear and to be able to tell stories of my past of recovery, survival, and healing through many of the stuff that we do. When we're selling, I talk to people and we talk about juniper berries and smudging, what it means that we are always able to purify ourselves, our energy that surround us. So that's what helped me to get to the point I am, and I'm very satisfied that I have been able to enjoy this moment that I can talk about my past of pain and recovery on this podcast. Thank you.
Thank you so much. So grateful. Thank you, Bessie.
You're welcome. I was so glad that I could share with other people.
On the October day when I was finishing up work on this episode, a headline from the Denver Post crossed my desk. A new report had identified at least 65 children who died in Colorado's two most prominent Native American boarding schools. New investigations across the country have identified hundreds of children who died at the more than 500 schools established to assimilate Indigenous people. Those investigations continue. And those investigations are turning up just why these schools existed. The driving force behind the expansion of the boarding school system, Richard Henry Pratt, is famous for saying, "Kill the Indian in him and save the man." I grew up with the stories of my great-grandparents carving out a life on their homestead in Arizona. That life was hard and it was good. And that's what I knew about the American dream. But I have come to see that any story of America must begin with the first people who called this place home. The millions of people who called this land Turtle Island and saw the land, the trees, the water, the eagles, and the buffalo not as property to be owned or extracted, but as family, an integral part of their own life, identity, and survival. This history, the history Bessie recounted, the numbers of children who died in these schools, and the tens of thousands who had their hair cut, their names stolen. It's more than a narrative of the past. It's a living account of who we are that continues to shape our lives today, that continues to shape my life today. On that hot August day, walking down the path from Bessie's house, I wondered how people whose ancestors were brought to this land against their will experienced this idea of the American dream. How do Black Americans who trace their story to slavery feel about this myth? I reached out to my friend Ben Sanders, who shared with me the complexity of this question, the complexity of piecing together stories of the past when even the stories are held in pieces and parts. Join me next week for Complexified, Dreaming America, Episode 3, Dreaming While Black. These stories are hard to hear, and they might leave you wanting not simply to understand, but to take action. ILF Professor Tink Tinker, a citizen of the Osage Nation, tells us that the first thing we must do is listen to the honest truth. That we killed Indians, cheated Indians, and stole land in order to create this romantic experiment called the United States. We are not powerless. People and organizations are taking meaningful action through land back initiatives, reparations movements, fighting the extraction of fossil fuels, and ensuring Indigenous children are raised in Indigenous communities. See our show notes at complexified.org for ways to learn more and take action. Thank you so much for joining us. Sign up for our monthly newsletter to continue the conversation. If anything in this conversation inspired you or sparked your curiosity, please share it with a friend. That is the very best way to support us. Complexified is presented by the Institute for Religion, Politics, and Culture at ILF School of Theology. This episode couldn't have been created without the magic of story editor Elaine Appleton Grant. And as always, working hard behind the scenes is our student intern, Josh Perez. Our sound engineer is Jasmine Hunjin, and the team at Podcast Allies. I'm Amanda Henderson.